everybody, and welcome to this week's episode of This Anthropological Life. As always, I'm Anil Tripathi.
I'm Amy Haynes.
I'm Adam Gamwell.
And I'm Ryan Collins.
We're all back for our first kind of full TAL team episode in quite a while. Mm-hmm. Adam just got back from Peru and Amy from Cameroon, back from the field, and Ryan was also out hanging out doing his archaeological excavations, and of course I'm back from my first round of field work in London. So we thought this would be a nice time to kind of come together and, as we do on This Anthropological Life, reflect on something that is so integral to anthropology, which is field work, right? Mm. Which we all just came back from diving into a bit. And I think in the discipline, right, there's always this kind of, there's almost like this cloud around field work, right? There's, everyone knows that you have to, you're not an anthropologist unless you do field work, right? But there's always this sense that you don't really know what fieldwork is until you actually get out there.
Mm-hmm.
Even though so much of our work, you know, as PhD graduate students initially is getting our projects ready so we can go do fieldwork.
Yeah.
So we thought, you know, this would be a good time for us to just reflect on what we've discovered about what fieldwork is so far.
Yeah. So I want to tag on to that point, because it's true that the fieldwork is this thing that you have to do, or what we might call a rite of passage. But I think you're rightfully saying, Anil, is that it's something that you don't know until you do it. And even, you know, there's tons of books written about how to do ethnographic fieldwork, how to take notes, you know, how to get informants. You know, one of the best books is called Learning from Strangers. But even these books don't necessarily prepare you for this kind of adventure, as it were. One of the things that really strikes me is and I want to dive into, is this process of, like, between fitting in and what I want to call fitting out, you know, because as an anthropologist, you get to know people intimately. You spend time in their daily lives or visit them often, if not every day, and just to sort of see what, you know, how they think, you know, how they do, what sort of motivates their behavior and their actions, and how knowledge gets formed, or how ideas get shaped, or how action is put together. And, you know, part of it, the power of ethnography is that it only works by actually being there and doing it, right? Because, I mean, so much of the power of ethnographic research is not in someone's public statement, but in sort of what they do before or after the speech, you know, or when they're sitting there thinking about what they're going to say for the speech, you know. And that's where we get to call the ethnographic gold, you know. That's the stuff where someone, like, has a little quip or a little off-the-cuff statement that you say, okay, that's really what you're thinking. Yeah.
They capture the experience almost.
Right, right.
And, I think it does seem, doing kind of field work, one of the things I noticed for me, you know, working in an office setting, what I always seemed to be kind of finding was, just through working in this environment, I was experiencing something. I was experiencing what all the fellow people working with me were doing, mm-hmm. right? And I was really interested in the organization I was at, what kind of work they did. Hmm. And for me, you know, I would write down things, my reflections, but there's also seemed to be this kind of, almost this feeling, right, by being in a certain environment on a daily basis, which I think is really essential to field work, right? This idea that when you want to understand a group of people or a community, you need to be there, and you get this kind of feeling, you get this sense for it almost.
Mm-hmm. Right. And it's interesting I'm really curious to get everybody's perspective on this more. It's that, you know, this feeling of, hey, yeah, you sort of get a feel for the game, as I think Bourdieu would say, the theorist Pierre Bourdieu, by being there. But then on top of that, this notion that, do you ever really fit in? Because you're not there being somebody's friend, you're there as a researcher, which is a really interesting position I found, you know, emotionally and physically too, to be in this space of, you're there working alongside, for me, quinoa farmers or NGO employees or government mm-hmm. employees or agronomists that do agricultural science or whatever. A lot of different people, you know, but I'm not any of these things. I'm the anthropologist. I'm this other being that's there, that I have a role to play too. But, you know, part of it is about not entirely fitting in, I feel. I don't know. You know, it seems to be sort of, I've been in the field for 5 months now, which is still quite short, I suppose. You know, I'm shooting for a year and a half, and Amy's shooting for about the same. And Anil, at some point, I imagine you'll do the same. In archaeology, you do different kind of stints, you know, but
exactly.
There's something about being in but also being out, you know.
Oh, I can agree to that 100%. And for me, though, I'm looking at materials that are actually coming directly out of the ground. You have this problem where you're either fitting in or you're fitting out, as you're saying. And it's not necessarily that you're like, oh, I understand what this material is, but you're looking at things that you literally have no idea how to interpret, that are that belong to a group that you're thousands of years removed from, and a way of thinking that you can barely imagine. So when you think you're fitting in, and when you think you understand what you're seeing, that's actually the problem. Because now you're identifying too much. You're like, ah, I found some ceramics here, so that must be something I can understand.
Interesting.
And when you find like an assemblage of materials, or if you overlook something because you don't think it's anything, you could easily be mistaking something that had a large amount of social value.
I'd like to take a moment and hear what a little blip about what each of you were doing over the past couple months, because I know for me, I was at a chimpanzee sanctuary in Cameroon, and I had to try to fit in more than fit out for a lot of reasons, but mainly because I wouldn't have access to these people or to the chimps that I was trying to get to know otherwise, since it's a place that is so short on labor and that is so time-crunched, because caring for chimps is 14, 16, 20-hour day sometimes. And so in order to be talking to caregivers, I could not show up as the, you know, professional question asker. And I couldn't even show up as a curious student. I had to show up and bring something to the proverbial table, which was for them labor. And so I did field work and did participant observation under the guise of being a volunteer. And they already have a volunteer structure in place, as do many, if not just about all sanctuaries, chimp sanctuaries at least, in many parts of Africa, and here in the U.S. too for reserves. So I went and had to try to fit in and then almost do my anthropology around it. And that had a different host of problems. So I was, I guess, to start us off about what we were each doing, I was trying to understand care and how conservation education really contributed to what it means to care, or how it attempted to contribute to that between humans and chimps, and how caring was used as a way to sort of structure relationships, interspecies relationships. It's changed a lot since then, but that's what I went in thinking I was going to be doing. And so I was a volunteer, which meant that I woke up at 5 a.m., 6 a.m., depending on if I had to make breakfast for all of the chimps. And I provided direct care to a lot of them and throughout the day, all day long, every day, and snuck my anthropology in before and after snacks and feedings and things like that. So can we just go around maybe and do a quick blip about what everybody's doing?
Yeah,
absolutely.
Yeah? I think I really identify with what you said there, Amy, that, you know, for you to even be in the environment you wanted to be in to research, you had to be fully engaged there, right? You had to become a worker in the organization, right? And I had a very similar experience for me working in a nonprofit in London, working to grow the green bond market. You know, this is a resource-strapped NGO. I couldn't just be hanging out and, you know, just over people's shoulders while they were at computer screens. Mm-hmm. I had to be actively doing the work myself. Mm-hmm. And for me, I found that was, you know, also an integral way to really understand what was going on, right? So I was working on policy papers. I was trying to understand how information is created within markets, how a market is developed. And so for me, you know, I went in, I was working 9:30 to 6:30. And it was very interesting also, I mean, going back to what you were saying earlier, Adam, about the kind of relationships you make, you know, whether you really fit in. Because also, for me, I was in a very particular type of place, right? With a place that's very demarcated in Western society of work, right? So this idea that you have your life outside of work and then you have what you do at work. So I was entering that sphere as a worker, right? I became a researcher in this organization. And I'm sure, you know, the interactions I had with people around me were framed by this place of work, right? So, and all of us existed within that sphere, right? Whereas, you know, the people I'd work with, we'd act differently if we were in the office versus we'd get a bar. I mean, we'd get a beer after work at a bar. So there's, you know, I think that's one of the really fascinating things, right? When you enter these spheres and you get to learn about them. And I think definitely, as you were saying as well, Ryan, it's so important when you're in field work to, you know, don't narrow your point of view so quickly, right? You have to have that kind of open-mindedness to kind of reflect on what you're experiencing.
Mm-hmm. For me, the fieldwork process is, I think, a lot more like ethnographic work than it might seem at first. I would basically wake up every single morning to go find my group of informants from the local village of Yashunam, and then I'd drive them out to the field site. And usually I'd have about 10 to 15 or so individuals working with me for excavation, and we all speak English, not English, Spanish as a second language. So we're all sort of having these discussions that sometimes they can be really good, but often there's a lot of miscommunication, which is part of the whole fun process of investigation. But we all go out to the site, we investigate together, and we get into debates. You know, basically, excavation is a conversation about detective work. Because you find something, and then people are like, well, I think this is something very similar to what we do in a village. This is something like a ritual that we do to open a new house. And then somebody else might say, no, that's more like just a trash pit. No, that's where we cook chicken. So you have to kind of like take everything with a grain of salt. But you have the conversation, and that's the most important part, that you can have all these different ideas out there. And what people who are living off of this land are thinking about it as well. So you get several different perspectives, all have very different types of weight, but all equal weight.
Hmm. In a similar way, I think for all of us, to add on to yours, it sounds like, because also with your thing, you're working on an archaeological project that's for a season, right? And so the idea, of course, is too that you are also coming as a laborer, right?
Exactly. So I'm coming as a laborer for a season. My informants are oftentimes people from the village, but realistically, the most important informants I get are the materials that come out of the ground. So digging is like finding friends. You dig in the ground, and then you find your discussion, your people that you have discussion with. Maybe it is a person from the past, a skeleton, and you can read into that what you will. But oftentimes it's a ceramic sherd. It's a piece of broken obsidian glass. And that's where you make friends, is in the field. But then you have months and months and months of material analysis afterwards, where you really interrogate the materials that you're finding, where you subject them to chemical testing, where you subject them to different types of x-rays, and whatever else you can imagine to get as much information as you can out of it. And at the end of the day, you take all that and you make the story.
A story to be told, yeah. In a similar way, yeah, I'm in Peru right now. Well, I'm in Massachusetts with my TAL crew, but I'm normally in Peru. And the project I'm working on is with quinoa, and I am working at the intersection of farmers and agricultural scientists and marketers. I haven't done the marketer angle yet. That'll come later in the fieldwork, probably later this year or early next year. But what I'm looking at is the emergence, and similar to something that Anil's doing, actually, is the emergence of a sort of a commodities market. Quinoa is already a relatively famous food. You know, you can buy in the United States at Whole Foods, or even Walmart sells it now. But what I'm doing in Peru is working with a group of multilateral stakeholders, or just a bunch of different people from quinoa farmers themselves, to agricultural scientists who work with the farmers, to NGOs that help give funding or information or what they call capacity building for farmers to be able to grow different kinds of quinoa, all the way up to government employees that sort of see this from on high, or as somebody said, up among with the gods the other week, which I just loved. Ethnographic gold right there. But anyway, so I'm looking at this bigger project of what quinoa is, how it's emerging as a commodity. But the thing is, when we think of food, we might say, okay, so I can get my red or my black or my white quinoa here in the United States, but we don't really have any idea about the actual process that goes into growing the quinoa, to identifying it, to classifying it, to picking what varieties will become standardized, to who does the standardization, to who owns the quinoa that they're selling, who gets to sell it, who gets to buy it, what happens when it goes from point A to point B, et cetera. So this whole map of quinoa that is sort of unseen in the markets here, but then also even working in Peru, I'm finding that it's really quite complicated. Particularly, one of the things I'm most fascinated with now is how quinoa is classified, because they're different. I work with gene banks, I work with NGOs, I work with farmers, and they all classify quinoa differently, and they don't translate to each other very well. Mm-hmm. That's perfect work for an anthropologist, because it's saying, if we take all these systems of knowledge, what can we do and how do we put them together? And what of these different systems will then actually form the commodity version of quinoa that you and I want to buy? But also, like Amy and Neil and Ryan were saying, that I'm also part of a project as a laborer. I'm not just hanging out. I mean, I am just hanging out, but I'm, you know, like you guys too, I am part of a team. Mm-hmm. I don't work by myself, but I'm part of this team that is sort of between the farmers and the agronomists and the NGO and the government. And so I play both an important role in making the project happen, which is, you know, again, we're working with farmers on biodiversity conservation of quinoa, like keeping multiple varieties in a field at one time so we don't just monocrop. So that's what the NGO is working on, and I'm sort of studying them doing this, working with them, but, you know, but also working to make this project happen. So it's this interesting mix of, you know, the farmers are really my main ethnographic subject, but working with these other groups, you know, it's I don't know, this is a big picture, but like yourselves, you know, so it's, I have to be part of a team to even have access to these, to any of these people. And so that's been, it's an interesting role, as you said, it creates both opportunities and problems, because you're beholden in different ways to different people.
Right.
You know, you can't just show up and say, all right, let me do interviews with you, and then I'm going to step out. But you have a set of responsibilities beyond just doing ethnographic research.
Can you talk more about problems? So you just mentioned one of time, like one with conflicting you have an interview in your head that you want to get down.
Right.
What are some of the other problems that any of you encountered in being tethered to an organization?
Sure. It's a great question. One of them is, I mean, so one of the things that anthropology does really well, I think, is looks at the complexities of relationships between institutions and people and groups and ideas. Now, one of the challenges with that is, again, since we each work with an institution, more or less, at a conservation group or with, you know, a finance corporation or with an NGO or even with a branch of government or farmers or people in a village, how you then sort of critically analyze what one part of this whole that REIT's looking at does can affect other ones, you know. And of course, people have access, you know, I think we've all probably on some level promised our informants access to our materials when we're done with them.
Absolutely.
So how you can sort of keep ethnographic confidentiality by not giving away who you're talking to, because one of the big things of ethnographic research that we have read about, as we write our projects later, we'll see how this happens, but, you know, you can't give away who you're talking about. That's one of the you know, the anonymity or confidentiality is an important part. And so particularly with some of the groups I'm working with are high profile in Peru, it wouldn't be hard to figure out who they were, you know. So it's a game of trying to figure out how to best sort of, you know, give an accurate representation of who it is that I'm working with without giving away who they are, because that can affect them socially or politically or whatever, you know, beyond my project. So that's one thing. And then a second, of course, is how do you offer a good critical analysis of what you see going on without insulting people? I'm trying to think of a better way to say that, but that's kind of how it is, right? By saying this thing isn't working because these two people aren't talking. But then if those two people read the piece that you wrote, then they say, wait a minute, you know, she said that, wait a minute, you know, that can be an issue.
And I think what you're getting is there's several different conversations going on, and we're all accountable to several different levels of groups that have interest in our projects. And to get into this, you know, I've had a lot of similar experiences to you. And I forgot to mention that I actually have a focus to actually doing archaeology earlier, that I am asking questions. I'm not just going randomly digging holes in places in Mexico.
That's good.
I would hope so. So I'm looking at the role of memory and the use and change of the landscape while political systems changed over time. So with that in mind, I'm recognizing that the people I'm looking at the earliest period were hunter-gatherers. And then at a midpoint, you're looking at a chiefdom. And then sometime after that, you're looking at some sort of city-state. And disentangling what do hunter-gatherers look like? What do people in a chiefdom look like? What do people in a city-state look like? And how do you differentiate those is difficult. But on another level, you're asking questions that are having concerns for your dissertation, that are having concerns for your university, the departments where you're coming from. But then you're also asking slightly different questions for people you might be applying for grants from, or permit holders, if you're applying to, like I do, to work through the state government. But then you have to address their concerns. What do they want? And that's a dialectic conversation, you know? You give a little, they give a little, and you have to sort of come to an agreement.
Right.
Then you have to do the same with the village. So one group is going to want one thing, but another is going to want another. And like you said, sometimes the desires don't overlap. And if you want to say to the village, I found this and we think it's that, they may say, no, it's not that. And you can't talk about that because it relates to this. There becomes a little bit of a problem and tensions that have to be alleviated.
Yeah, that's a great point. That's something that I run into too, is that if I'm working with groups of farmers, they would want help with the business plan to work with their farm, but I'm there in the first place to help the agronomists talk to the farmers about getting seeds. And so there's these very different, you know, like they can be different conflicting things that you sort of have to find a way to do both. at least well enough that they both say, okay, this is good. You're allowed to be here. And that does become kind of an issue. You know, it hasn't yet become a huge problem, but it's definitely the more time I spend, the more as I get to know these different groups and I spend time with them, I can see how this is something I need to continuously be aware of, right?
Yeah, I think it's really almost a balancing act, right? When you're in between all of these different, obligations that you have with people you're working with in the field versus, your obligations to the department and what your advisors want to see from your work, who you should be citing in kind of anthropological texts. But I think, for me especially, I really want my work to be of value to the people I'm working with, right? And I think, as you brought up, Adam, it's such a tricky thing, right, to try to create an objective reflection on the work you're doing in a way that will try to get the people working in these fields to kind of take what you're saying.
They have to buy into it.
Exactly, and try to kind of go in a positive direction, right? Because I think in order to get anthropology more kind of out of the academy and into kind of, I guess, daily thought, we have to think about how can we make our work accessible, but we need to make our work accessible to all the different people we have obligations to, right? So how do we make it accessible to our advisors who might want us to cite all these different people, and then to the those outside of
then for a great
academia.
Episode on TA.
Yeah.
I'm going to diverge a little bit and say that it's not possible to fulfill. When you enter a situation where they have defined terms where they are set up against one another. They are adversarial. They have been adversarial before they ever encountered you, and they want to continue to be adversarial because they do not want, respect, have the same values as the group they consider themselves to be against, or if some big rift has happened in this organization or in the larger community, and you have to pick a side. And we've run into this with people we've read, right? Mm-hmm. Like, I know Elizabeth Ferry, who mentors, several of us, talks about very clearly, like, you can't, she's worked with mining companies in Mexico, and miners, and sometimes you can't walk in and smile and accommodate everyone because people won't let you sit in the middle of the road. If you're eating lunch every day with one group, another group is going to interpret things about that. So
absolutely.
So I think too, some of this, we take values into the field, and then we get into the field and we have to make sense of them. And I am learning, and if someone else knows a better way than me, I would love to hear it, but that quite honestly, you cannot accommodate all these people who want you to accommodate them in some way.
Yeah.
Oh, absolutely not. This year I had to learn that firsthand by dealing with competing political groups within Yashunam. And the tensions were a little high for a while, but it was actually pretty tranquil in the village compared to some other local villages where things got really out of hand. But certain people of certain political affiliations didn't want excavations to happen anywhere near farming land. And others were trying to open it up in specific farming land that was out of disuse, that wasn't going to be used for another, say, 7 or 8 years. And it wasn't a matter of the land being occupied or not. It was just a matter of party affiliation, who was going to get money. And if we contracted more people from the village who are of one affiliation than another, it became a problem. And it was a problem that was voiced by both groups openly and actively. Sometimes it was very heated, and sometimes it was quite calm. Finding a mediation point was difficult. And it often involved trying to get people together in town meetings that happened, I'd say, 3 or 4 nights a week, where you have big conversations. It's got to be funny from the perspective that here are a bunch of gringos from the U.S. all speaking in broken Spanish trying to mediate between local political issues.
And that have been there for a long time.
Exactly, that are not going away. These political issues have been there before many of the individuals who are championing each side were even born. So we're talking about generational problems that go into just the fact that that's going to happen whether we're there or not. And we're just another piece to that puzzle.
Right. But then, Amy, you've got a great point that it's like when you plunk yourself in there, you can't sit on the side of the you can't sit on the fence, right? Like people will make you choose a side. And that's
you have to eat lunch somewhere. Yeah, that's my metaphor for it. Who are you sitting with? That's like, you've got to eat lunch somewhere.
Where in the cafeteria you're going to go,
I think, Abu Lugoda has a very good reflection on this with her work with the Bedouin, that, for her, she was coming to this community in part through her father, right, with connections as an Arab trader. And for her, she had to accept the role that she had within this community. And realize that if she really pushed hard on this, she wouldn't be able to talk, she wouldn't have been able to stay there. Mm-hmm. So for her, she got a tremendous amount of value through kind of existing within these constraints and taking this role. I think, like, as you were saying, Amy, you can't, when you go into an area, you just can't sit on the sideline, right? Because otherwise you're really not going to get much of value, right? Because you're just going to be...
No one will talk to you. Yeah.
So you'll get it's like a supposed basic idea of everything, but you'll never get the real experience, which I think a lot of us are getting in these, in basically on the sides that we've chosen, right? In the organizations we've chosen to work with.
Mm-hmm.
And I think this also really gets to just kind of the nature of anthropological knowledge, how it always exists. It is always charged in some way, right? There's any objectivity, it comes from these subjectivities and the sides that we take, really.
Yeah, it's tricky. I've already been put in some weird positions myself too with money, which is almost, it feels worse in some ways, that people are expecting to be paid and they're asking me for the money. I don't know if that's because I was the gringo anthropologist or the role they saw me
as. Gringo with the NGO.
And
if you're in a white vehicle, I don't know for you guys if it's white vehicles, but in Africa, if you're
in a white vehicle.
The white person in the white vehicle, you're the person we talk to about money.
You're the ambulance with the money.
Yeah, exactly.
I've certainly been approached different ways and with different levels. I mean, with students, with farmers, with different people about money issues. And it's an interesting position because it's part of it is do I simply pass it off because I really don't handle money, except for my own meager finances, to get from point A to point B, but they expect me to.
Mm-hmm.
And that it's a sort of an awkward position because it's, really, the short answer is, like, I don't deal with that. Sorry, talk to somebody else. But at the same time, you don't want to just say, let's not talk. But say, like, what is the issue of the money? What are you having with money issues that we're talking about here?
I'm the anthropologist. Explain all your problems to me. I can't fix them, but explain them to me really quickly.
Well, that's the other thing that I've been really reflecting on about fieldwork is that it's that point. Like, we're therapists without actually doing therapy. And that's a very weird role, too. Because it is sort of like, let's talk about what issues are going on with you. Let's get to know you and tell me about your problems. But then I can kind of help you. Yeah. But the question is also, or should I, or how can I? And this is it's sort of the applied, sort of the basic research question, but it's beyond that because we're talking about actual relationships too.
Yeah.
You're getting into something I want to ask you guys about. And I didn't, we haven't discussed this question off air. So sorry if I'm springing this on you, but I'm really curious about rookie mistakes. Like, where you kind of go, oh my God, like,
shouldn't have done that.
Forehead in my palm. I can't believe I did that. But I made one, so I'll start off. And I'm curious to know if any of you have any others to share. And I wish, if someone had told me before I went this, I probably wouldn't have. I hope that I would have considered it, but who knows if I would have or not. But I think, because we have conversations for years before we go to the field about our political alliances, and we're a discipline that's different because we care about, the situation of those we ask questions of. We want to respect them. We want to protect their privacy and their identities and all these things. So we consider ourselves, I'd say, we're allies of the underdog, or we aspire to be in whoever the underdog is in said situation. And so I go in, to the place that I am doing research with, and I am there as a potential ally to the underdog. And so I think that I assumed, I don't know why, that people knew that my intentions were heartfelt.
Mm.
And so I came off as really nosy early on because Cameroon is a place where you do not ask personal questions. Like, people share things with you in layers over many conversations over time. And once I was there for 4 months, there was once or twice where I had a conversation and I just thought, oh my gosh, you just opened up like things for me that I did not understand for 3 months. In a matter of 5 minutes, you decided that I was trustworthy enough to share something with. Thank you for giving me that, piece of information. But I realized that people watched me very early on because I was so nosy. Like, who is this, young white female American grad student walking around asking me about my woes, you know, and I'm thinking, of course, I'm not going to tell anybody, you know, tell me what's going on. Like, what's hard here? What's difficult? Mm. But I was like, what a rookie mistake. Like, just because you think you want to be an aspiring ally does not mean that you seem trustworthy and, you know, on the up and up to people who you are asking odd questions of.
That's a really interesting point. My thing in related, I don't know if it's a rookie mistake, but it's and maybe we might also say this as things we wish we knew when we went into the field, which, again, I don't know how valuable those are because you don't know them until you actually do them also.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
Either way, but in a similar regard for mine, one thing I found is what other people expect the anthropologist to do.
Yeah.
Mm. And that is very different for an NGO to a government employee to an agronomist to a farmer.
Mm-hmm.
And while that's okay, I mean, and I'm happy to talk to them and say, well, I do that or don't do this,
mm-hmm.
Or who I'm looking at. You know, scientists do not expect me to look and study with at them,
mm-hmm.
if we can say
mm-hmm.
with at mm-hmm. somebody, you know,
yeah, yeah.
Which is fair. And so they're like, oh, look at the farm. That's really interesting. The farmer's doing. I'm like writing, but I'm writing what the scientists think is interesting about the farm.
Yeah. What they're trying to tell you to look at.
Exactly. Yeah, yeah. So there's that kind of sort of look over that way, Adam, and I look that way, but I'm also looking back at the scientists
mm-hmm.
too, because together that's and I explain. I say I'm looking at how science and farming come together to make quinoa, and they're like, okay, good. Look at the farmers. You know,
I think I'm really kind of struggling with this as well. It's almost how do you explain to people who you want to be kind of the subject of your project as well, what you're really doing. Because I've tried, because I've talked quite a bit with those I'm working with, you know, what my project is going to be overall. And some of them, you know, their spouses will be anthropologists. So there's a lot of people who kind of know what anthropology is. But then, you know, either maybe it's because we're all just working quite a lot and, you know, everyone has a lot on their minds. But it seems sometimes I feel people kind of don't really understand what I'm doing.
Mm-hmm.
But then it's all right because
too.
I'm doing, you know, I'm in my researcher role as well, right? So I have a role for them as
right.
well.
So. Well, it's that same thing of I can explain to somebody what I'm doing, but when I say I'm an anthropologist, then that's a good start. They're like, oh, okay, you're doing anthropology. That means you're studying somebody else.
Mm-hmm.
And they leave it at that. So it's even though I'll say, let's look at quinoa classification.
Actually, a project on what you're doing.
What you're doing too, but also together, you know, it's like, but regardless, it may just be because I speak crappy Spanish. I don't know. But to explain that is really difficult also in a different language.
Yeah. Well, I guess I don't have that excuse. It's all in English.
I tried to explain it to my family a couple weeks ago. We all speak English, and it did not work. So I don't – I doubt it's your Spanish.
I just brought back 9 kinds of quinoa for my family. It's like, here's what I do.
That's good.
It's easier, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
Just don't talk. Eat this. Okay.
Yeah, there you go.
But
I actually had a very opposite experience of what Amy was talking about. And where I'm working, people are very, very open. So if you're an anthropologist and you come in, they want to tell you everything they can possibly
think of.
Except that it can be often gossip. They want to know, they want to let you in on all the gossip of the village, anything that's a little, you know, might seem a little strange at first, but often the subject is highly sexual. And then they have often the people from the village have secondary names for all the archaeologists, which have one meaning in Maya and then another sexual innuendo name.
Kind of like giving a professor a hot chili pepper on Rape My Professor?
Yeah, basically.
Okay.
And
I was trying to explain that to someone recently. They're like, why would people do that? And I don't know.
Yeah, I won't go into any of the
good point.
Meanings or any of the names that are given. It's just, you know, your comfort zone gets tested immediately. And you don't know how to respond to that at first. And I made the rookie mistake of being like, oh, how could you say that? I'm so offended. And they looked at me like, oh, what? That was offensive? Well, why are you upset? I'm like, oh, no, I'm not upset. Please continue on. And you have to get into that different type of boundary level because you need to be open with this and open-minded that if you want to have other information, these conversations have to happen.
Yeah, that's a good point.
That could go either way, though, right? Because if you say you're offended, then you see how they act to a boundary that you just tried to set up.
It would.
I see what you're saying, that it would shut something down, but you get another kind of information, too, if you give more of an honest response. I played with responses. Several times I played with responses about giving, I don't even know what to call it, a very watered-down version of my regular, I'll call it human reaction, you know, just what was about to come out of me or what would have come out of me at home.
Right.
I would give a really watered down version of that. And then there were a couple times where I don't know if it's because my field site was really kind of extreme physically, but I was like, you're getting it. Like, you're getting my real human reaction. And then I'll make field notes later. But we need to, I need to step out of, you know, Sweet Sally researcher here where I'm trying to understand everything. And I need to be my full self for, for a little bit.
This is in French or English?
That's funny. I tried to be my full self in French, but it was like, you know, my, I don't know, like I'm a third grader, very angry third grader.
I'm angry.
Yeah.
Like, in Spanish.
Me subtitle. Is mad. Yeah.
We angry. Yeah.
I don't know, you know, some of this will go into work later, so I don't know how much to dive into now, but I guess a quick vignette about when I was my full self was a moment as a volunteer. I was less responsible. I would say I was less accountable for the mechanics of caring for adult chimpanzees than the actual caregivers. Hmm. So I could feed them, I could groom them, I could interact with them. But in terms of moving them from enclosure to their cage where they sleep at night, that was very limited to what I was supposed to be doing. And I was with a caregiver, and there was some misinformation I was given about a door I could open, and an adult chimpanzee got out.
Oh, no.
And I'll, you know, end up writing about this in more detail later. But afterwards, we were both asked what happened, and we had different versions of the story. And so my full human self came out. You know, I did A, I did not do B. And that was not going to be a moment where I was going to sit back and watch, you know, my counterpart's reaction. Mm-hmm. So, I guess I just want to point out with what you said, Ryan, tack on that sometimes given a full reaction gets you another kind of data.
Oh,
when,
for sure.
When people see what makes you angry, that you know, and how they react accordingly. If they want to quell your anger, if they'll engage with you face-to-face, if they're mad at you but they talk and they won't look at you, like that's something in Cameroon. Sometimes you're angry, you don't look directly at the person while you're upset. So anyway, yeah, just kind of pointing that
out. It's a good point to think about. What, something that I want to jump into, and I would love to hear your thoughts too, since we're all doing this, is how do you write field notes? I know that probably sounds really boring, but as you just said, Amy, like in the middle of this anecdote, you're like, I'm going to either react right now or write this down later. You know, and the idea of even that idea of do I react, do I write? How do we record these experiences that we have? Because for one, I mean, I think we've all had discussions that it is exhausting to do a day of field work and then have to go home at night and write for 2 hours, you know, which I don't do. You know, also I usually write in blips and in spurts, you know, versus like one chunk at the end of the day or something for my own energy level, because it's really, I find it really hard to do that.
Do you handwrite or do you type directly onto a computer?
I do both.
Okay.
I prefer to type because I can type faster.
I think it's kind of nice having the diversity of mediums to take field notes. I mean, for me, so since I was working at a computer, I'd have a field notes file that, you know, sometimes I'd write in stuff on the side during the day as my observations. And then I had a journal that at home that, you know, it was basically a calendar journal with fairly small amount of space per day. So I would always, I like that constraint because then I would, you know, just get the basic things of the day out. You know, what did I do? Some very quick observations and just have that kind of little blurb. And then, you know, at the end of the summer, just having all of these pages, you know, is really nice kind of for me to reflect on while also having the kind of in parallel this Word doc with all these observations throughout the days.
I tend to do my note writing on Evernote, the software, which is nice because it does it per day. And obviously it keeps your day because you're writing on a computer, but it tells you related things at the bottom of the note. So it's like, you wrote about this before, which has been nice for me. It's like when I'm going back and looking at notes, I can sort of compare if I did something a different day. One thing I found helpful is that in my physical notebook, like I will only do paper notes during a meeting or an interview, like, but I'll type by myself later at some point. On the actual sheet of paper, I'll, you know, like 2/3 of it will be note, and then I'll write a line down the middle, or down on the last third of the page, and that's like my notes, reflections on what's happening, and then like the 2/3 is what's happening in the meeting, like the meeting notes, if you will, and then the other side of the page is like how I'm reflecting or what people are saying or doing or wearing or thinking, which is, so it's sort of this bifurcated note system that allows me to say, oh, this person keeps referring to other someone else as this. Where the meeting, I'm just saying they're discussing this type of quinoa. You know, so I try to keep them both, so that way, like, they're sort of in timeline tandem sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know. I mean, so there's, I don't know, there's a plethora of ways you could take notes, you know. But even on top of that, just being aware of, like, what kinds of things do we write down, you know. I mean, I was reading some blog post about the idea of digitizing field notes, and that a student was reflecting. She was doing a digitizing project of her advisor's field notes from 20 years ago. And she'd look at the field notes in her file, and there were dinners attended, and numbers of people, and who was there, and what they were wearing. And I don't know, do we go into that level? Do you go into that level of detail? I mean, I don't write down what people are wearing. Maybe I should. I don't know. I haven't so far. I don't know what chimpanzees are wearing up there, overalls.
I I jot down when people's clothes. Sometimes, when I first met people, I would get a lot of what they wore. But I would write down sometimes, too, if what people were wearing was important to them. Like when people dressed up, how they dressed up. Or if somebody thought they had a cool new shirt on, why was that shirt cool? things like that seemed helpful. I actually use handwritten notes, computer notes, and then audio notes. And I handwrite because I journal a lot. And if I'm particularly upset, good, or if I'm particularly excited, sometimes handwriting feels good to me, but it's more tedious because it takes longer. Yeah. Like you said, you type faster.
Hmm.
I have to use jottings because it's really weird for someone to walk around with a notebook to write down what people say. It's very invasive.
It is weird, yes.
I had people stop talking to me. Even Westerners would, if I pulled out a notebook, I saw one person got actually alarmed, and she said, well, let me go talk to someone higher than me before I finish answering your question. And so part of me is I feel two ways about that. First off, it made me concerned. Are people forgetting that I am taking notes? Like, I explained to people that what we're doing is data for me. Do you all remember that I said that? You know, because I am going and writing notes at night. But then the other part of me knows that not everything I write down is ever going to make it somewhere, you know, out in public. And so, you know, the vast majority of what I write down is background information for what I'm trying to understand. But then I had to use audio notes if I was with the chimps. Like, I would take infant chimps into the forest. And you cannot use a paper and pen with toddlers.
That makes
like,
sense.
They take it. I battled a baby for a pen once. And I won, but I battled her. Like, it was intense. I almost got bitten. So I had to use audio notes a lot, which is awkward because I don't like the sound of my voice particularly. Mm. So if anyone has tips out there about how to audio note in a less self-conscious way, I would be really interested.
I'm the same way. It's not fun to hear it, you know, yeah.
Yeah, it's really awkward.
I mean, truly, it takes then twice as long to do audio notes, too. But I record interviews, too.
Yeah.
And then you have to go back and listen to them. Because that was an hour interview. Now I have to listen to it for an hour. And if I take the time to transcribe it, which I haven't yet, that's another 3 hours just to do one thing.
And transcribing is such a fascinating process itself, right? Because it's almost then an interpretation of the recording.
Right.
In terms of, you know, how you write it up, what you stress, you know, while you're transcribing, you can even choose, you know, what sections you decide to take out and really focus on from the recording. So it's almost, I think these are all parts of really the process of, you know, kind of knowledge creation in anthropology, which goes through all these different levels, right? In terms of what we're experiencing in the field, what we then reflect on, and then how we try to negotiate what we've written with, you know, all the people we have obligations to, as we mentioned earlier.
Indeed.
Hey, for me, the notebook is entirely old school. You know, I work in the rainy season down in Mexico, and it's just impossible to actually have a computer because that type of media would just easily be destroyed if I had it out in the field and then, say, like a monsoon hits. It's like all the electrical equipment's done. But I always have a camera on me, too. So every time I'm taking some sort of technical note or recording a conversation, I can always turn on the camera and I can always take a photo or I can video the situation as well. And having that additional media is really helpful for me in piecing all this stuff together afterwards. But what becomes a little scary sometimes is when you're working with a larger project and you're trying to make sure that there are copies of all your data and people want to copy your notebook. That makes me a little hesitant.
What?
Wow. Nobody sees
under what circumstances would somebody want? Oh, you mean co-researchers?
Co-researchers for, you know, a larger project. So I have my own sub-project with the group that I work with.
Okay,
but for the overall project, if that data should be lost on the plane or in some sort of weird circumstance, as it happens sometimes, people want copies. Not necessarily to read it themselves, but to just have as a backup. So handing my notebook over, which has information that maybe I don't want everybody to see, because sometimes notebooks for me are like a personal journal or like recording field notes or thoughts of after a strange situation. Mm. They don't necessarily want everybody reading that.
Yeah,
no. Well, like Malinowski, for example.
Or anybody, I was just thinking that. I didn't want to be rude and be like, don't get Malinowski.
I'm not
but you shouldn't be doing Malinowski type things anyway.
Right.
You know?
That's
like,
true.
Hopefully,
definitely
yeah,
not that
that's
level.
The
but
caveat.
More like a personal interaction. So you're like, oh, I'm nervous when so and so shows up today because I want to have all this cleaned up and, you know, this isn't working out the way that I thought it was or something like that. More of like a personal anxiety type of thing as opposed to any of the things that Malinowski was.
For reference, he was lusting after local women.
Exactly.
And
he was also quite racist, and he kept that in a separate diary that
his wife published when he died. So.
Payback. I also want to give a shout out to Sarah Lamb, who is also at Brandeis, in Brandeis's anthropology department, and she stresses jottings, and I found that to be quite useful. You know, where you, out of a conversation, you pick three or four key words to help you recall it. And so I would often sneak off to the bathroom, or if I could walk in my room 2 minutes under the guise of putting on sunscreen, right? Like, I'm going to do some jottings from that crazy interaction that I just witnessed. Those were useful. And then I also keep my own, I try to differentiate a little bit with my own interpretations versus like just recounting a conversation by using parentheses, and I put my initials and then like a little.
I do that too.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And then my thought is in the parentheses. So
can you, what is jotting? Is it speed writing? Is it short?
No,
sentences?
Jotting's how it's explained to me and then how I've read about it is you have like a pocket size notebook. So I would get tiny little notebooks.
Those are important.
Actually, yeah, a really skinny one. And I numbered them. And so.
Smart.
In that notebook, I would, if someone talked about, you know, let me try to think of an actual conversation. We talk about a certain chimpanzee. He's trying to be integrated into a group, and he's not behaving appropriately, right? And the staff they're kind of assessing how the other chimps in the group are acting, and they're evaluating whether or not the other chimps are good caretakers, blah, blah, blah. So that's really interesting to me. And so, you know, in my jottings, I've got the chimp's name. I've got the other two chimps' names because now I know their names after I've been there a while. And I've got three or four words that capture that conversation. And if anything was particularly poignant, I will try to get a quote down as much as I can. I also use nicknames for people. And so because I was constantly worried about that notebook falling out of my pocket. And I use I like my own abbreviated sort of shorthand, not a full shorthand, but a little bit of a shorthand. So I would use that too in case I lost it. Or chimp took it. And
I think
got it.
I think actually the digital like Word document I have on my computer almost served the equivalent for jottings, right? Because I'd be working for most of the time, and if just something came up, I'd just write a quick snippet in this Word document, right? And then kind of be reminded later and try to reflect on it more.
Yes, that's the thank you. You just described the second half of jottings, which is you actually go back and write it out afterwards.
Okay.
So, yeah, it's just a capture in that moment.
Cool.
And Sarah really talked about, you know, slip in the bathroom, you know, with your pen and notebook, and you jot a couple words down and find a private space. Yeah.
That's a good thought. Something else I do with that is when I do my physical notes, because I do have some of those, you know, small 2-inch by 2-inch notebooks. That is interesting because I've been working with this entrepreneur in Peru, and he pointed out, he actually did his undergraduate in anthropology, so he's got some anthro-minded thinking, which has been useful to sort of share some ideas with. And he actually helped me, he reminded me, he said, keep in mind, like, it's good to use bring your, because I have a bigger and a smaller notebook, he said, bring your smaller notebook because it's less threatening when you're talking to somebody, because if you have this big thing, as you said, Amy, too, they can kind of stop.
Like, what
and
are
say,
you keeping
like,
in there?
What are you reading? But a smaller one, they don't think about it. Yeah. Like, they sort of passes over them because it fits in my hand. So you can sort of like just kind of have it down by your side and throw down a word while you're talking to them and not have to sort of pause and write. But what I'll do with anything I handwrite, again, using as like an Evernote commercial, I will then scan into Evernote. So I have digital copies.
We are not sponsored by Evernote.
We're not. But if you want to sponsor us, that'd be perfect.
Give us a call.
1-800-TAL. No. But I will scan all my notes in. So like, and the nice thing about this is that then it, you know, digitally OCRs it so that you can search the text on it and becomes text searchable. So that's been a nice, because if I ever lose my notebook, that's one problem because I use people's initials, so I can probably figure out. Maybe I should change them to all like numbers or something. Yeah. But
flip around.
Everybody gets
characters.
A nickname for me when I first meet them.
It's a great
them.
Idea.
Yeah.
Maybe I should look. I should look into that. I'm finding it's more of an intersectional study because I'm working with so many groups. There are so many people that show up. I have a lot of nicknames, but it could be done, you know? That could be Waldo, Waldo 2, Waldo 3, Waldo 4.
Well, the category of... I give the category of people a nickname, and then they get a number sometimes. Like, you know, chimps didn't necessarily need a nickname, but... I mean, it's funny, but I that sounds silly, but actually some caregivers were concerned about how much I wrote about chimps, and even if I disguised a caregiver's identity, if I said there was a caregiver who felt this way about this particular chimp, they said that because they all know who likes and dislikes certain chimps, if they read it, they might know who that person is based on the description of that caregiver and their relationship with the chimp. So I wouldn't nickname them, but like say, you know, caregivers, they, you know, as a class get a certain type of nickname and then a number or something based on how I met them. But that takes a lot of remembering, but once you get it down, I find it easy to...
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
I've actually seen people use emoticons to get over this problem.
Well, that's if you've got electricity, right?
Exactly. Or you have an iPhone like Adam's talking about with you.
Yeah. That's a good point.
Do we have time for one more quick thing? You just touched on, and it's something that has recently started to kind of weigh at my brain, and it's working with all these different types of groups. Once I got, the first couple months, you're trying to figure out who's who, what's happening around you, just the basics. And I realized very quickly that I, being so closely tied to an organization, I'm not located in a village. I'm not getting the larger social fabric. Right. I'm working in an organization where almost everyone is speaking their second or third language with one another. So I can't use one language to sort of infer things about a group of people, an ethnic group, you know, a place, you know, how we map, you know, French people are this way, and I derive that from these parts of the French language and how it's used. So I didn't have that to go off of often. So I thought of James Ferguson and his book Expectations of Modernity in Zambia, where he was one of the pioneers in doing more urban ethnographies. And he talked a lot about how his narrative was so uncohesive because he was in a city. And in a city, people ignore you. Like, you know, you stay in your house more often than if you're in a small rural community, no matter where you are in the world. And he said there are some, you know, commonalities to cities that mean that people's relationships are more fragmented. And he said, my work is going to reflect that. And so I thought of that with this organization because I'm not out in a community. And on the one hand, it's good because it automatically disrupts any idealistic notions I have of creating this coherent narrative of what Cameroon is like, right? Because there is no coherent Cameroon for anyone. But on the other hand, it is such a discombobulating thing that the fact that an organization is holding you together, or that's your point of reference, and you're seeing people in their work lives, and you see you learn a ton about people, but it feels very one-sided. Does that trouble anyone else?
I'm with you there too, and that I have continuously wrestled with this. Is that I'm same with you that I'm organizations are holding me together. It's like I'm not in, and I'm never going to be in one village. I might do one small stint later, which we can for our third reflection episode. but as of right now, like you, Amy, I'm literally hopping from city to city to rural area back to city to these totally different disparate areas with different people. A in work. You know, and not so much in their just a regular, you know, hanging out, not working lives. And that was very, it still is troubling because I was afraid that I'm somehow not going to get the right ethnographic data because they're only at work with people.
Kind of this wistful, like, what am I missing?
What am I missing? Right, yeah. Exactly. But then it's funny because I, to hit on our good friend Malinowski again, one of the things that I remember about his, because he has one of them, like, some of the most famous, the Argonauts, the Western Pacific ethnographies, and one of the better ethnographies ever written. And it's written in the style where it's just sort of the anthropologist looking outward at the natives, quote unquote, and that we only see the natives. But remembering that in the actual situation, there was other European settlers like two camps away from where he was.
He said you should ignore.
Yeah, he was not just by himself, you know. But yet we have the idea that we're just by ourselves, you know. And so that's not really not that helpful, but it helps me to reflect that, like, even Malinowski, who wrote the classic ethnography, was not just there by himself, and he was actually doing these sort of these moments too. I've also been thinking about the idea of like, this is sort of an intersectional study where different groups of people come together for something, whether it's conservation in the case, or in my case, it's quinoa conservation, or chimp conservation, right? Or it's commodification of green bonds or quinoa commodification or whatever.
Or in Adam's case, a fire pit, a marriage, we're not sure yet, but people were at that site for something.
Yeah, exactly.
In the past, yeah.
So that kind of, so it's like these, that's, I mean, it's, I think that's okay, because even like I think of George Marcus's too, when he, when the idea of multi-sided ethnography was this new thing, and now it's pretty much standard, which is, you know, I think for the most part, but in his sort of his theoretical point was you can follow the thing or the people and pick what you're following.
And even
talking to Elizabeth Ferry the other day, I sort of said the same thing. I was like, I was troubled for a long time. I still am. I'm not anywhere.
Yeah.
I'm in a lot of places.
That's a good
and that
point.
Makes me
I'm
feel
in
like
an
I'm
office.
Not,
yeah.
I'm getting breath, but am I getting depth?
Yeah.
And that's that's sort of the fear. And she said it's interesting because I'm saying I'm following. But my the way I said it was like, I'm following this thing that's quinoa and how quinoa shows up. And she's like, that's the point. It's like following. How do you find that thing? And then what is that thing that you're even following? Is it just the organization that's keeping you together? That's what it feels like to me. I'm like, oh, the NGO is keeping this all together. But is that what's keeping it together? You know,
that's an excellent point.
Is that what I'm following?
Yeah.
For me, I think I've almost been trying to deal with this in terms of looking geographically or kind of even spatially. So I am, you know, within the organization that I'm working with, I am almost in a type of work community. So the office space I'm in London is a climate finance / climate activist hub. So there are lots of different organizations that are kind of, you know, lots of work is overlapping. So there's a very particular community in this building, which I've experienced with, you know, new espresso machines being brought in and all the different organizations coming together. So I've seen that as kind of a way to be interacting with a particular type of community. You know, one community that is also very, very bound in a particular sphere, going back to this notion of work. But I've also been trying to then reflect on how this building and this work in climate finance relates to the, you know, practices and work of finance generally within London. So looking at, you know, trying to really ground physically where these kind of spheres of finance are existing, even though the work that's being done in London is work that influences projects all around the world in terms of different, you know, financial operations. So it's, yeah, I think, I mean, maybe a way to deal with this kind of sense that you're just in this slice is to really just, you know, acknowledge the boundaries, I guess, and reflect on the boundaries that you're within, right? And then that shows you the richness, right?
And certainly, I mean, one of the most useful things that we're all doing right now is we're back in Massachusetts, not at our field sites, and getting a little distance is goes a long way, you know? And so I found even anybody I've talked to, it's sort of step away for a minute too, and then you can kind of say, what was it that I was in? Because when you're in it, you're in it. And for the first 3 months, I was completely disoriented. I was in Lima, in this like massive city, doing a few different random things with different people, and just sort of thinking, what am I even doing? A, because I'm in a city, where's quinoa? I'm, you know, terrified that I'm going to be stuck in this giant city and not even be to the farms where it's, again, supposedly where the research is, but there's a reason I was in the city, you know, and I was with the people that I was with. But when I went to the other, I work around Puno in the south by Lake Titicaca, and when I went there, then I could look back at Lima and say, oh, I see what I was doing there a little more, you know. Again, I still need to massage it and think about it, but any form of distance helps too, you know. So actually coming back here for a short break in between fieldwork has been invaluable in that regard also. It's also been good just to not think about it for a minute.
Yeah.
I got back and went crazy and cleaned my whole house top to bottom. I was like, I need to put something in order because my brain is so disordered.
Yeah, yeah. I played Legos for 2 weeks, you know.
Restructure your brains.
Exactly. I think just days at the beach staring.
Just building sandcastles, right?
Exactly.
Well, thanks so much, everybody, for tuning in and hearing our kind of our step backs from our fieldwork experiences. And, there'll be much more to come as we continue to dive into our long PhD journeys in anthropology.
That's right.
I think all Stay of us with are us going guys. Back at some point. Real soon, too.
We'll be back. Some soon, some a little less soon, but we'll all be back and we'll have more reflections to reflect upon. Reflecting on the reflections.
So keep tuning in, everybody, and we'll catch you very soon. Signing off, this is Anil Tripathi.
This is Ryan Collins.
Gamble.
And